Histories, Book 1, Clio. Herodotus of Halicarnassus, this is the display of his inquiry, so that neither what has happened among men may fade with time, nor great and marvelous deeds, some accomplished by the Greeks, some by barbarians, may become without fame, including, in particular, the reason why they waged war against each other. Now the learned men among the Persians say that the Phoenicians were the cause of the dispute. For these, having come from the sea called the Red Sea to this sea, and having settled in this region which they still now inhabit, immediately took up long voyages, and carrying Egyptian and Assyrian cargo, arrived at various other places, and in particular at Argos. Now Argos at that time surpassed all the peoples of the land now called Greece. And when the Phoenicians arrived at this Argos, they set out their cargo for sale. On the fifth or sixth day from their arrival, when nearly everything had been sold, many women came down to the sea, among them the daughter of the king. Her name, as the Greeks also say, was Io, daughter of Inachus. These women, standing by the stern of the ship, were buying those of the goods for which they had the greatest desire. And the Phoenicians, urging one another on, rushed at them. Most of the women escaped, but Io, along with others, was seized. They put them into the ship and sailed away toward Egypt. Thus the Persians say Io came to Egypt, not as the Greeks say, and this was the first of the wrongs. After this, they say that some Greeks, for they cannot give the name, put in at Tyre in Phoenicia and seized the king's daughter Europa. These would have been Cretans. So far these things were equal to equal, but after this the Greeks became the cause of the second wrongdoing. For sailing in a long ship to Ea in Colchis and to the river Phases from that place, once they had finished the other business that had brought them there, Medea, the king's daughter, was seized and taken away by them. The king of the Colchians then sent a herald to Greece demanding compensation for the abduction and asking for his daughter's return. The Greeks replied that since the Colchians had never paid compensation for the abduction of Io of Argos, they in turn owed the Colchians nothing. They say that two generations later Alexander, son of Priam, upon hearing this story, decided he wanted a wife carried off from Greece, being quite certain he would face no punishment for it, since no one else ever had. So once he had carried off Helen, the Greeks resolved to first send envoys demanding her return and compensation for the abduction. The Trojans, faced with this demand, threw back at them the abduction of Medea, arguing that the Greeks themselves, having neither given satisfaction nor given her back when she was demanded, wished to receive satisfaction from others. Up to this point, there had been only seizures on both sides. But from this point on, the Greeks became greatly to blame, for they were the first to begin marching an army into Asia, before the Persians marched into Europe. Now to seize women is held to be the act of unjust men, but to make a great effort to avenge women once seized is the act of foolish men, while to pay no heed at all to women who have been seized is the act of sensible men. For it is clear that if they themselves had not wished it, they would not have been seized. The Persians say that they, the people of Asia, made no account at all when their women were seized, but that the Greeks, for the sake of a Lacedaemonian woman, gathered a great expedition, and then, coming into Asia, destroyed the power of Priam. From that time on they have always regarded the Greek people as their enemy. For the Persians claim Asia and the barbarian peoples living in it as their own, but they consider Europe and the Greek people to be separate. This is how the Persians say it happened, and it is in the capture of Troy that they find the origin of their hostility toward the Greeks. But concerning Io, the Phoenicians do not agree with the Persians in this way. For they say that it was not by seizure that they brought her to Egypt, but that while in Argos she had intercourse with the ship's captain, and when she realized she was pregnant, out of shame before her parents, she sailed away willingly with the Phoenicians, so that it would not become known. These, then, are the accounts given by the Persians and the Phoenicians. But I myself, concerning on these matters, I am not setting out to claim that events unfolded one way rather than another. Instead, I will name the man I myself know to have been the first to commit injustice against the Greeks, and having pointed him out, move ahead with my narrative, covering the cities of men both small and great without distinction. Cities that were once great have mostly shrunk down small, while cities great in my own day were once insignificant. Since I recognize that human fortune never stays fixed in one place, I will treat both kinds equally. Croesus was Lydian by descent, son of Aliats, and lord over the peoples living within the river Halys, a river that flows from the south between the lands of the Syrians and the Paphlagonians and empties northward into the sea called the Euxine. This Croesus was the very first foreign ruler known to us who forced part of the Greeks into paying tribute and won others over as allies. He forced the Ionians, Aeolians, and the Dorians settled in Asia into submission and made allies of the Lacedaemonians. Before Croesus took power, all Greeks were free, since the Sumerian force that had earlier struck Ionia, arriving before Croesus's time, was not a conquest of cities at all but merely a raid conducted an incursion. The rule passed in this way, belonging by descent to the Heraclids, into the family of Croesus, called the Myrmnidae. There was Candaules, whom the Greeks call Miasilis, ruler of Sardis, descendant of Alcaeus, son of Heracles. Phoregron, son of Ninus, son of Belus, son of Alcaeus, was the first of the Heraclids to become king of Sardis, and Candaules, son of Miasis, was the last. Those who ruled this land before Agron of this land were descended from Lydus, son of Aedes, the man from whom the entire people took the name Lydian, having earlier been called Maeonian. From these people, the Heraclids, given rule through an oracle, took power, sprung from a slave woman belonging to Iordanus together with Heracles, and they held power across 22 generations of men for 505 years, each son inheriting from his in the rule, down to Candaules, son of Miasis. This Candaules, then, fell in love with his own wife, and being in love, he believed her to be by far the most beautiful of all women. Holding this belief, for among his spearmen Gyges, son of Dasylus, was the one who pleased him most, to this Gyges, Candaules used to entrust his more serious business, and indeed, he also praised excessively the beauty of his wife. Not much time had passed, for it was fated that things should go badly for Candaules, when he said the following to Gyges. Gyges, since I do not think you believe me when I speak of my wife's beauty, for men's ears happen to be less trustworthy than their eyes arranged to see her naked. But he cried out and said, Master, what unsound thing are you saying, ordering me to look upon my mistress naked? A woman, when she takes off her tunic, sheds her modesty along with it. Long ago fine things were discovered by men, from which one must learn. Among these is this one, let each look to his own. I myself believe that she is the most beautiful of all women, and I beg you not to ask for what is unlawful. Speaking thus he resisted, fearing that some harm should come to him because of them. Candaules replied to him in these words, Have courage, Gyges, and do not be afraid, either of me, I only say this to test you, or of my wife, that some harm might befall you on her account. Right from the outset, I will arrange matters so that she never even realizes you have looked at her. I will station you inside the chamber where we sleep, just behind the open door. Once I have entered, my wife will come in as well to go to bed. Near the entrance stands a chair. She will remove her clothing piece by piece and set each garment on it, giving you ample opportunity to observe her at leisure. Then, once she leaves the chair and moves toward the bed with her back turned toward you, make certain from that spot onward that she never spots you slipping out through the doorway. Since escape was impossible, Gyges made himself ready. And when Candaules judged the hour for sleep had arrived, he brought Gyges into the chamber, and shortly afterward his wife came in too. Gyges watched her enter and set down her garments one by one. And once her back was turned as she moved toward the bed, he crept out unseen, though the woman spotted him leaving. Realizing what her husband had done, she neither cried out from shame nor let on that she had noticed, already resolved to punish Candaules for it. Among the Lydians, and nearly all other non-Greek peoples besides, a man being seen naked counts as a source of deep disgrace. So at that moment she gave no sign of it and kept quiet. But as soon as day came, she made ready those of her servants whom she saw to be most loyal to her, and summoned Gyges. He, thinking she knew nothing of what had happened, came when called, as he had been accustomed before, whenever the queen summoned him, to attend her. When Gyges arrived, the woman said the following, Now, Gyges, of two paths that lie open to you, I give you the choice, whichever you wish to take. Either kill Candaules and have me and the kingdom of Lydia, or you yourself must die right now, so that in the future, obeying Candaules in everything, you may not see what you should not. For either that man who devised this must perish, or you, who have seen me naked, and having done things not customary. Gyges for a time was amazed at what was said, but then he begged her not to compel him by necessity to decide on such a choice. He did not persuade her, but he saw that a real necessity lay before him, either to destroy his master or to be destroyed himself by others. He chose to survive himself and asked her this. Since you compel me to kill my master against my will, come, let me hear by what means we shall attack him. She took this up and said, the attack will be launched from the very place where he showed me naked, and it will come while he is asleep. When they had prepared the plot and night had come, for Gyges was not released, nor was there any escape for him, but it was necessary either that he himself perish or Candaules, he followed the woman into the bedroom, and she gave him a dagger and hid him behind that same door. Afterward, while Candaules was resting, Gyges slipped out, killed him, and took both the woman and the kingship. This Gyges, whom Archilochus of Paros, who lived at the same time, mentioned in Iambic Trimeter. He took the kingship and had it confirmed by the oracle at Delphi. Once the Lydians took Candaules's death hard and rose up in arms, an agreement was struck between Gyges's supporters and the remaining Lydians. If the oracle named him king of Lydia, he would rule, but if not, power would revert to the Heraclids. The oracle did name him king, and so Gyges became king. Yet the Pythia said this much besides, that vengeance for the Heraclids would come in the fifth generation after Gyges. Of this pronouncement, the Lydians and their kings took no notice until it was fulfilled. In this way, the Myrmidae took the tyranny away from the Heraclids and held it. Gyges, once tyrant, sent no small number of offerings to Delphi, as many silver offerings as he sent. They are the most numerous at Delphi belonging to any one man. And besides the silver, he dedicated a vast quantity of gold, among other things, one especially worth remembering. 6 golden mixing bowls are dedicated there. These stand in the treasury of the Corinthians, weighing 30 talents. Though, to speak the truth, the treasury does not belong to the Corinthian state, but to Cypselus, son of Aeson. Of all the non-Greeks known to us, this Gyges was the earliest to send dedications to Delphi, after Midas, son of Gordias, king of Phrygia. For Midas, too, dedicated the royal throne on which he used to sit and give judgment, a thing worth seeing. This throne stands in the same place as the mixing bowls of Gyges. This gold and silver that Gyges dedicated is called by the Delphians Gygen, after the name of the man who gave it. Once he became king, he too led an army into Milesian and Smyrnaean territory and took the city of Colophon. But no other great deed was accomplished by him in his 38-year reign, so we will pass over him having mentioned this much, and I will make mention of Ardes, son of Gyges, who reigned after Gyges. This man took Priene and invaded Miletus, and it was during his tyranny over Sardis that the Cimmerians, driven from their homelands by the nomadic Scythians, came into Asia and took Sardis, except for the Acropolis. Ardes reigned 49 years and was succeeded by Satiates, son of Ardes, who reigned 12 years. Satiates was succeeded by Aliates. This man made war on Cyaxares, the descendant of Deoses, and on the Medes. He drove the Cimmerians out of Asia, took Smyrna, which had been founded as a colony from Colophon, and invaded Clazomenae. From these campaigns, he did not come off as he wished, but suffered a great defeat. But other deeds he accomplished in his reign are most worth relating, as follows. He waged war against the Milesians, having inherited the war from his father. Advancing against them, he laid siege to Miletus by this method. Whenever the crops in the land had ripened, he would launch his invasion, marching his army to music from pipes, harps, and flutes played by both women and men. Once he reached Milesian land, he left the farmhouses standing untouched, neither tearing them down nor burning them nor ripping off their doors, letting them remain in place. Yet whenever he had destroyed the trees and the crop in the land, he withdrew again. For the sea was in the Milesians' control, so that a blockade by his army was pointless. The Lydian did not tear down the houses for this reason, so that the Milesians, using them as a base, could go on sowing and working the land, and he, while they worked it, might have something to damage each time he invaded. Doing this, he waged war for 11 years, in which 2 great defeats befell the Milesians, once when they fought at Limnaean in their own territory, and once on the Maeander plain. During 6 of those 11 years, the Lydians were still under Satiates, son of Ardes, and it was he who was then leading the army into Milesian land, for it was this Satiates who had begun the war. The following 5 years after the 6 were fought by Aliates, son of Satiates, who, having inherited the war from his father, as I have already shown, pursued it intensely. None of the Ionians eased this war for the Milesians, except the Chians alone. These repaid like in giving aid, for earlier the Milesians had joined with the Chians in their war against the Erythraeans. In the 12th year, when the standing grain was being burned by the army, it happened that the following thing occurred. As soon as the grain caught fire, driven by the wind it caught the temple of Athena called the Ephesian, and the temple, having caught fire, burned down. At the time no notice was taken of it, but afterward, when the army had returned to Sardis, Alyattes fell ill. As his illness dragged on longer, he sent envoys to Delphi to consult the oracle, whether on someone's advice or because he himself decided to send and ask the god about the illness. When they arrived at Delphi, the Pythia refused to give an oracle until they should rebuild the temple of Athena, which they had burned at Assisos in Milesian territory. I know that this is how it happened, as I have heard it from the Delphians. But the Milesians add the following to this account. That Periander, son of Cypselus, being on the closest terms of guest friendship with Thrasybulus, then tyrant of Miletus, learned of the oracle given to Alyattes and sent a messenger to tell him, so that, knowing it in advance, he might plan for the situation accordingly. So the Milesians say it happened. Alyattes, when this news was reported to him, immediately sent a herald to Miletus wishing to make a truce with Thrasybulus, and the Milesians for as long as he was building the temple. So the mission went to Miletus, but Thrasybulus, having already learned the whole story clearly and knowing what Alyattes intended to do, devised the following scheme. Whatever grain there was in the city, both his own and privately owned, he had it all gathered into the marketplace, and he told the Milesians that, when he gave the signal, they should all drink and hold revelry with one another. Thrasybulus did this and proclaimed it for the following reason, so that the herald from Sardis, seeing a great heap of grain piled up and the people in a state of enjoyment, would report it to Alyattes, which is indeed what happened. For when the herald had seen those things, and had told Thrasybulus the Lydian king's instructions, and had gone back to Sardis, as I learn, nothing else brought about the reconciliation. For Alyattes, expecting there to be a severe grain shortage in Miletus, and the people worn down to the utmost extremity of misery, heard from the herald returning from Miletus the opposite report from what he himself had supposed. After this, the reconciliation between them came about on the terms that they should be guest friends and allies with one another, and Alyattes built two temples for Athena at Assisos instead of one, and he himself recovered from his illness. So it went with Alyattes concerning the war against the Milesians and Thrasybulus. Periander, who revealed the oracle to Thrasybulus, was the son of Cypselus, and this Periander was tyrant of Corinth. To him, the Corinthians say, and the Lesbians agree with them, the greatest wonder of his life happened. Arion of Methymna was carried to Taenarum on a dolphin, a man who was second to none of the lyre singers of his time, and who was the first man we know of to compose, name, and teach the dithyramb at Corinth. This Arion, they say, who spent much of his time with Periander, desired to sail to Italy and Sicily, and having made great wealth there, wished to return to Corinth. Setting out from Tarentum, and trusting no one more than Corinthians, he hired a ship crewed by Corinthian men. But once at sea, they plotted to throw Arion overboard and keep his money. Realizing this, he pleaded with them, offering them the money and begging only for his life. But this plea did not move them. The sailors ordered him to choose, do away with himself so as to get burial on land or leap into the sea without delay. Driven to this extremity, Arion begged them, since this was their decision, to let him stand in full costume on the deck and sing, and once he had sung, he promised he would make an end of himself. And the sailors, delighted at the prospect of hearing the finest singer alive, moved back from the stern toward the ship's middle. Arion then dressed himself in his full performance costume, picked up his lyre, stood on the deck, and sang the Orthian melody all the way through, and when the song ended, he flung himself into the sea exactly as he stood, costume and all. And they sailed on to Corinth, but the dolphin, they say, took him up and carried him to Taenarum. He disembarked and made his way to Corinth with his gear, and on arriving related everything that had happened. Periander, disbelieving the story, kept Arion under guard and let him go nowhere, while keeping close watch on the sailors. When they duly arrived, they were summoned and asked whether they had anything to report about Arion. The sailors said Arion was safe in Italy, doing well, and that they had left him behind at Tarentum. Whereupon Arion himself stepped forward, dressed just as he had been when he dove overboard, and the astonished men, caught out, could no longer deny the truth. This account comes from the Corinthians and the lesbians alike, and there stands a small bronze monument to Arion at Teanorum, showing a man mounted on a dolphin. Aliats, Lydian, after finishing the war against the Milesians, later died, having reigned 57 years. Having recovered from his illness, he dedicated at Delphi, the second of this house to do so, a great silver mixing bowl and an iron stand welded together, a sight worth seeing among all the offerings at Delphi, the work of Glaucus of Chios, who alone of all men discovered the welding of iron. On the death of son of Aliats, Croesus took over the throne at 35 years old. Among the Greeks, he attacked the Ephesians first. Under siege from him, the Ephesians dedicated their city to Artemis by running a rope from her temple all the way to the city wall. 7 stadia separate the old city under siege from the temple. Against these people first, then Croesus made his attack, and afterward, in turn, against each of the Ionians and Aeolians, bringing different charges against different ones. Against those where he could find a greater charge, alleging something greater, and against others even bringing trivial accusations. When the Greeks in Asia had been subdued to the payment of tribute, from then on he conceived the plan of building ships and attacking the islanders. But when everything was ready for the shipbuilding, some say that Bias of Preen came to Sardis, others that it was Pittacus of Mytilene, and when Croesus asked if there was any news from Greece, he said the following and made him stop the shipbuilding. O king, the islanders are buying up countless horses, intending to march against Sardis and against you. Croesus, hoping he was speaking the truth, said, Would that the gods put this into the minds of the islanders, to come against the sons of the Lydians with horses. And the man replied, O king, you seem to me to be praying eagerly to catch the islanders on horseback on land, and reasonably so you hope. But what do you think the islanders are praying for? Other than that, as soon as they learned you were planning to build ships against them, they prayed to catch the Lydians at sea, so that they might take vengeance on you for the Greeks living on the mainland, whom you hold enslaved. Croesus was greatly pleased with this conclusion, for it seemed to him aptly spoken, and persuaded, he stopped the shipbuilding. And so he made a bond of friendship with the Ionians who lived on the islands. As time went on and nearly all the peoples living within the Halys River had been subdued, except for the Cilicians and the Lycians, Croesus held everyone else under his own authority, having conquered them. They were Lydians, Phrygians, Mysians, Mariandinians, Chalybes, Paphlagonians, Thracians, both Thynians and Bithynians, Carians, Ionians, Dorians, Aeolians, and Pamphylians. With these peoples brought under Lydian control and added to Croesus's domain, Sardis, then flourishing with wealth, was visited by every notable thinker from Greece then living, each arriving there in his own time. Among them the Athenian Solon, who, having drafted laws for the Athenians at their own request, then left home for 10 years, sailing off under the guise of sightseeing so he would not be forced to repeal any law he had established. The Athenians themselves could not do this, since they were bound by weighty oaths to follow whatever laws Solon set for 10 years. It was for these reasons, and for the sake of sightseeing, that Solon left home and came to Egypt, to the court of Amasis, and also to Sardis, to Croesus. On his arrival, he was entertained in the royal palace by Croesus. And then, on the 3rd or 4th day, at Croesus's command, servants led Solon around the treasuries and showed him everything, all of it great and splendid. When he had inspected everything as time allowed, Croesus put this question to him, My Athenian guest, plenty of talk about you has reached us here, concerning both your wisdom and your travels, how, driven by a love of learning, you have journeyed across much of the world just to see it. So now a longing has taken hold of me to ask whether you have yet come across anyone who is the happiest of all men. He asked this expecting that he the most fortunate of men. But Solon, without flattering him at all but speaking the truth, said, O king, tell us the Athenian. Astonished at what was said, Croesus asked sharply, On what grounds do you judge Tellus to be the most fortunate? He said that Tellus, in the first place, lived in a city that was prospering, and had sons who were fine and good, and he saw children born to all of them and all of them surviving. And also, having lived well by the standards we have, he met a most glorious end to his life. For when the Athenians fought a battle against their neighbors at Eleusis, he came to the rescue, routed the enemy, and died most nobly, and the Athenians buried him at public expense on the very spot where he fell and honored him greatly. When Solon had thus provoked Croesus by telling him at length of the many good things concerning Tellus, Croesus asked whom he had seen as second after him, expecting that he would surely win second place. But Solon said, Cleobus and Biton. These were Argive by birth and had a sufficient livelihood, and besides this such strength of body as follows. Both alike were prize-winning athletes, and this story too is told of them. When there was a festival of Hera for the Argives, it was absolutely necessary that their mother be conveyed to the temple by a yoked cart, but their oxen did not come in from the field in time. Since they were running out of time, the young men themselves put themselves under the yoke and pulled the wagon, with their mother riding upon it, and having drawn it 45 stadia, they arrived at the temple. After they had done this and been seen by the assembled festival crowd, the best end of life came upon them, and in this the god showed that it is better for a man to be dead than to live. For the Argive men, standing around, blessed the strength of the young men, and the Argive women blessed their mother for having such children. And the mother, overjoyed both at the deed and at the fame, stood facing the statue and prayed that the goddess grant Cleobus and Beto, her own sons, who had honored her so richly, whatever is finest for a human being to receive. Once the sacrifice was made and the feast enjoyed following this prayer, the young men fell asleep inside the temple itself and never woke again, meeting their end there. The Argives had statues made of them and set them up at Delphi, as of men who had proven themselves the best. Solon thus assigned second place in happiness to these men, but Croesus, angered, said, My Athenian guest, has our happiness been so utterly cast aside by you as nothing, that you do not even count us worthy of ordinary men? Solon said, Croesus, you ask me about human affairs, though I know that the divine is entirely jealous and prone to trouble. For in the long span of time, there is much to see that one would not wish to see, and much to suffer as well. I set the limit of a man's life at 70 years. These 70 years provide 25,200 days, not counting an intercalary month. But if one wishes to make every other year longer by a month, so that the seasons may come round as they should, then over the 70 years there will be 35 intercalary months, and from these months, 1,050 additional days. Of all these days making up the 70 years, 26,250 in all, not one brings with it anything exactly like another. So you see, Croesus, man is entirely a creature of chance. As for you, you seem to me to be very wealthy and to be king of many men, but as to what you asked me, I cannot yet call you that, until I learn that you have ended your life well. For the very rich man is no more fortunate than the man who has enough for his day, unless fortune attends him so that he ends his life well, having kept all good things to the end of his life. For many very wealthy men are unfortunate, while many with moderate means are fortunate. The man who is very rich but unfortunate surpasses the fortunate man in only two respects, while the fortunate man surpasses the rich and unfortunate one in many. The rich man is more able to satisfy his desire and to bear a great disaster that befalls him, but the other has this advantage over him. He is not so able to bear disaster and desire as the rich man is, but good fortune wards these things off from him, and he is free of deformity, free of disease, untouched by misfortune, blessed with fine children, good-looking. And if besides all this he also ends his life well, then this is the man you are seeking, the one worthy to be called fortunate. But before he dies, hold back and do not yet call him fortunate, but only lucky. Now it is impossible for a human being to possess all these things together, just as no single country is self-sufficient in providing everything for itself, but has one thing while lacking another. The one which has the most is the best. So too no single human body is self-sufficient. It has one thing but lacks another. Whoever continues to possess the most of these advantages, and then ends his life graciously, that man, O king, it is right for me, king, to bear that name. One must look to the end of every matter to see how it will turn out, for the god shows a hint of prosperity to many, and then destroys them root and branch. By saying this to Croesus, he gave him no pleasure at all, and Croesus sent him away without a further thought, considering him a great fool, since he disregarded the good things at hand, and told him to look to the end of every matter. But after Solon had gone, a great retribution from the god seized Croesus, presumably because he supposed himself to be the most fortunate of all men. At once, as he slept, a dream stood over him which revealed to him the truth of the evils about to happen concerning his son. Croesus had two sons, one of whom was ruined, being deaf and mute, while the other, in every respect, was by far the first among those of his age. His name was Aedes. It was this Aedes whom the dream signified to Croesus, showing that he would lose him, struck by a spear of iron. When Croesus awoke and considered the matter with himself, in dread of the dream, he brought a wife for his son, and though the young man had been accustomed to lead the Lydians in war, he no longer sent him out on any such undertaking. Every javelin, spear, and similar weapon that men use in warfare he had carried out of the men's quarters and stacked away in storage rooms, worried that something hung up might fall on his son. Now, while he had his son's wedding under arrangement, a man arrived at Sardis burdened by misfortune and with blood-stained hands, Phrygian by birth, and from the royal family. This man came to Croesus's house and asked, according to the customs of the country, to obtain purification, and Croesus purified him. The purification among the Lydians is much the same as among the Greeks. When Croesus had performed the customary rites, he asked where the man was from and who he was, saying, "Fellow, who are you, and from what part of Phrygia have you come to be my suppliant at the hearth? And what man or woman did you kill?" He answered, "King, I am the son of Gordias, son of Midas, and my name is Adrastus. I killed my own brother unintentionally, and I am here, banished by my father and deprived of everything." Croesus answered him thus, "You happen to be the offspring of men who are my friends, and you have come to friends, where you will lack for nothing, so long as you stay in my house, and by bearing this misfortune as lightly as possible you will gain the most." So he lived in Croesus's household. Now at this same time, on Mysian Olympus, there arose a great boar, which, setting out from that mountain, kept destroying the crops of the Mysians. Often the Mysians went out against it, but did it no harm, while suffering harm from it themselves. At last messengers from the Mysians came to Croesus and said this, "King, a huge boar has appeared in our land, which is destroying our crops. Eager as we are to catch it, we cannot. Now therefore we ask you to send your son along with us, together with picked young men and dogs, so that we may drive it out of our land." They asked this of him, but Croesus, remembering the words of the dream, said this to them, "Do not mention my son again, for I would not send him with you. He is newly married, and that is his concern now. But I will send picked men of the Lydians and the whole hunting pack, and I will urge those who go to be as eager as possible in helping you to destroy the beast from your country." That was his reply. Though the Mysians were satisfied with this answer, Croesus's son came forward, having overheard what the Mysians were requesting. When Croesus refused to send his son along with them, the young man addressed him thus, "Father, once upon a time the noblest and finest pursuits open to us were earning distinction through campaigns and hunting expeditions. But now, you keep me shut out of both of these, though you have not seen in me any cowardice or lack of spirit. With what face must I now show myself, going to and from the marketplace? What sort of man will I seem to the citizens, and what sort to my newly wedded wife? What kind of man will she think she lives with? So you must either allow me to set out for the hunt, or persuade me by argument that it is better for me that these things be done this way." Croesus answered him thus, "My son, it is not because I have seen cowardice in you, or anything else unpleasing, that I do this, but a dream vision came to me while I slept and warned that your life would be cut short, for you would perish by a spear of iron. On account of this vision, I hastened this marriage of yours, and I do not send you out on undertakings, but keep watch, in hopes that I might somehow steal you away from death during my own lifetime. For you happen to be my only son, the other, being ruined in hearing, I do not count as mine." The young man answered him thus, "Father, you may be forgiven, having seen such a vision, for keeping watch over me, but what you do not understand, what has escaped you about the dream, it is right for me to point out. You say the dream told you I would die by a spear of iron. But what hands does a boar have, what iron spear that you fear? If it had told you I would die by a tusk, or by anything else resembling one, you would be right to do as you do, but as it is, it said by a spear. Since then our battle is not against men, let me go." Croesus answered, "My son, in this you win me over, by revealing your judgment about the dream. So then, being defeated by you, I change my mind and allow you to go to the hunt. Having said this, Croesus sent for Adrastus the Phrygian, and when he arrived, said to him, Adrastus, when you were struck by grievous misfortune, for which I do not reproach you, I purified you and took you into my house, providing for all your expenses. Now then, since you owe it to me for the good I did you first, to repay me with good, I ask you to become the guardian of my son as he sets out for the hunt, in case some wicked robbers appear on the road to do you harm. Besides this, it is also right for you to go where you may distinguish yourself, for this is your ancestral pursuit, and moreover you have the strength for it. Adrastus answered, King, otherwise I would not have gone to such a contest, for it is not fitting that one afflicted by such misfortune should go among companions faring well, nor is there any wish in me for it, and in many ways I would have restrained myself. But now, since you are pressing me, and I must gratify you, for I owe it to you to repay your kindness, I am ready to do this, and as for your son, whom you bid me guard, expect him to return to you unharmed, so far as his guardian is concerned. When he had answered Croesus thus, they set out afterward equipped with picked young men and dogs. On arriving at Mount Olympus, they searched for the beast, and having found it and surrounded it, they hurled javelins at it in a circle. Then the stranger, this man who had been purified of bloodshed, called Adrastus, throwing his javelin at the boar, missed it and instead struck the son of Croesus. He, struck by the spear, fulfilled the word of the dream, and someone ran to bring word to Croesus of what had happened, and arriving at Sardis reported to him the fight and the fate of his son. Croesus, thrown into turmoil by his son's death, lamented all the more bitterly that the one who had killed him was the very man he himself had purified of murder. Overwhelmed with grief at the misfortune, he called terribly upon Zeus of purification, calling him to witness what he had suffered from the stranger. And he also called upon Zeus of the hearth and Zeus of comradeship, naming the same god by these titles, calling him god of the hearth because he had unknowingly taken into his house and fed the murderer of his son, and god of comradeship because, having sent him as a guard, he had found him to be his greatest enemy. After this, the Lydians arrived carrying the body, with the killer walking behind it. He stood before the corpse and gave himself up to Croesus, holding out his hands and telling him to slay him over the body, recounting his former misfortune, and how on top of that he had destroyed the man who had purified him, and that life was not worth living for him. Croesus, hearing this, took pity on Adrastus, even though he himself was in so great a private grief, and said to him, I have from you, stranger, the full penalty, since you condemn yourself to death. But you are not the cause of this evil for me, except insofar as you brought it about unwillingly, but rather some god, one who long ago foretold to me what was going to happen. Croesus then buried his own son as was fitting, but Adrastus, son of Gordias, son of Midas, this man who had become the killer of his own brother and the killer of the one who had purified him, when the people had left the tomb in quiet, aware that he was of all men he knew the most heavily burdened by misfortune, killed himself over the tomb. Croesus sat in great mourning for 2 years, deprived of his son. But afterward the rule of Astyages, son of Cyaxares, overthrown by Cyrus, son of Cambyses, and the growing power of the Persians, put an end to Croesus's mourning, and turned his thoughts to whether he might, if possible, catch the growing power of the Persians before they became great, before their strength grew further. With this plan in mind, he at once set about testing the oracles, both those in Greece and the one in Libya, sending different men to different places, some to go to Delphi, others to Abie and Phocis. A further group he directed to Dodona, while yet others he dispatched to Amphiraus, to Trophonius, and to the Branchidae in Milesian territory. These, then, were the Greek oracles to which Croesus sent to inquire. And to Libya he sent others to consult the oracle of Ammon. He dispatched them around to make trial of what the oracles knew, intending, if any were found to speak the truth, to send again with a second question, whether he should march against the Persians. He gave the Lydians these instructions when he sent them out to test the oracles, that from whatever day they set out from Sardis, counting the days from that one, on the 100th day they were to consult the oracles, asking what King Croesus of Lydia, son of Aliats, happened to be doing at that moment. And whatever answer each oracle gave, they were to write it down and bring it back to him. As for what the remaining oracles pronounced, no source reports it. But at Delphi, as soon as the Lydians entered the hall to consult the god and ask the question they had been charged with, the Pythia spoke these words in hexameter verse. I know the number of the grains of sand and the measure of the sea. I understand the mute and hear the one who does not speak. The smell has come to my senses of a hard-shelled tortoise being boiled in bronze together with lamb's meat, with bronze laid beneath it and bronze laid over it. When the Pythia had given this oracle, the Lydians wrote it down and went off back to Sardis. And when the others who had been sent around also arrived bringing their oracles, Croesus then unrolled each of the writings and examined them. None of the others satisfied him, but when he heard the one from Delphi, at once he offered prayer and accepted it, believing that the only true oracle was the one at Delphi, because it had discovered what he himself had done. Once he had dispatched the envoys to the oracles and was watching for the appointed day, this is the scheme he devised. Having thought of something impossible to discover or guess at, he chopped up a tortoise together with a lamb and boiled them with his own hands in a cauldron of bronze, setting a lid of bronze on top. This, then, was the answer given from Delphi to Croesus. As for the response of the oracle of Amphiaraus, I cannot say what it gave to the Lydians when they performed the customary rites at the shrine, for that is not reported either, except that he too believed he had acquired this as an oracle that spoke no falsehood. After this, he sought to win the favor of the god at Delphi with great sacrifices. He sacrificed 3,000 head of every kind of sacrificial animal, and he burned on a great pyre couches overlaid with gold and silver, golden bowls, purple garments and tunics, hoping thereby the more to win over the god. And he ordered all the Lydians to sacrifice to the god whatever each of them had. When the sacrifice was over, he had a huge quantity of gold poured and cast into ingots, the longer ones 6 palms in length, the shorter ones 3 palms and a palm's breadth in height. Of these there were 117, and of them 4 were of refined gold, each weighing 2.5 talents. The other ingots were of white gold, weighing 2 talents each. He also had a figure of a lion made of refined gold, weighing 10 talents. This lion, when the temple at Delphi burned down, fell from the ingots, for it had been set upon them, and now it lies in the treasury of the Corinthians, where its weight comes to 6.5 talents, for a half talent of it melted away. When Croesus had finished all this, he sent it to Delphi, along with these other things besides, 2 very large mixing bowls, one gold and the other silver. The gold one stood on the right as you entered the temple, the silver one on the left. These 2 were moved when the temple burned, and the golden one now lies in the treasury of the Clazomenians, its weight 8.5 talents plus 12 mini, while the silver one stands in the corner of the forecourt, holding 600 amphorae, for the Delphians mix wine in it at the Theophania festival. The Delphians say it is the work of Theodorus of Samos, and I think so too, for it does not seem to me an ordinary piece of work. He also sent 4 silver jars, still standing today in the treasury kept by the Corinthians, and he dedicated 2 sprinkling vessels, one of gold and one of silver, on the golden one of which is inscribed the claim that it is a dedication of the Lacedaemonians, wrongly, for this too is Croesus's. One of the Delphians inscribed it so, wishing to please the Lacedaemonians, though I know his name and will not mention it. But the boy figure from whose hand water pours really was a Lacedaemonian gift, though neither of the sprinkling vessels was. Along with these, Croesus also sent many other unremarkable offerings, including round silver basins and a golden statue 3 cubits tall depicting a woman, said by the Delphians to be a likeness of Croesus's baking woman. Besides this, Croesus also dedicated the necklaces and belts of his own wife. These, then, he sent to Delphi, and to Amphiaraus, having learned of his virtue and his suffering, he dedicated a shield entirely of gold and a spear all of solid gold, both the shaft and the point alike golden. Both of these still lay, in my own time, in Thebes, in the temple of Apollo Ismenius. To the Lydians who were about to carry these gifts to the shrines, Croesus gave instructions to ask the oracles whether he should campaign against the Persians, and whether he should add any allied army as a friend. Once they reached the destinations to which they had been dispatched, the Lydians dedicated the offerings and consulted the oracles, saying, Croesus, ruler of the Lydians and of other nations, believing that these alone among all oracles known to men speak truly, has given you gifts worthy of your discoveries. And now he asks you whether he should campaign against the Persians, and whether he should add any army of men as an ally. This is what they asked, and the judgments of both oracles agreed on the same answer, foretelling to Croesus that if he campaigned against the Persians, he would destroy a great empire. And their counsel was that he should discover who among the Greeks were strongest and attach them to himself as friends. When Croesus heard the oracles reported back to him, he was overjoyed at the responses, and fully expecting to bring down the kingdom of Cyrus, he once more sent to Delphi and, having learned the number of its citizens, gave gifts to them, 2 gold staters to each man. In return for this, the Delphians gave Croesus and the Lydians the right to consult the oracle before others, exemption from taxes, front seats at the games, and the right for any of them who wished to become a citizen of Delphi for all time. Having given gifts to the Delphians, Croesus consulted the oracle a third time, for once he had accepted the oracle's truthfulness, he made full use of it. This time he asked whether his monarchy would be long-lasting. The Pythia gave him this answer: "But whenever a mule becomes king of the Medes, then, tender-footed Lydian, flee beside the pebbly Hermus and do not stay, and do not be ashamed to be a coward." When these words came to him, Croesus was pleased by them more than by anything else, expecting that a mule would never rule the Medes in place of a man, and that therefore neither he nor his descendants would ever cease from power. After this, he turned his thought to inquiring who were the most powerful of the Greeks, so that he might win them as friends. In his inquiry, he found that the Lacedaemonians and the Athenians stood out above the rest, the former of Dorian stock, the latter of Ionian. These were indeed the peoples marked out from of old, one being the Pelasgian nation and the other the Hellenic. The one never migrated anywhere, while the other wandered a great deal. For in the time of King Deucalion it inhabited the land of Phthiotis, and in the time of Doris, son of Helen, the country beneath Ossa and Olympus, called Hisiotes. And when it was driven out of Hisiotes by the Cadmeans, it dwelt in Pindus, being called Macedonian. From there it moved again to Dryopes, and from Dryopes it came at last into the Peloponnese, where it was called Dorian. As for what language the Pelasgians spoke, I cannot say for certain. But if one must judge by conjecture from those Pelasgians still existing today, who live above the Tyrrhenians in the city of Crestona, who were once neighbors to those now called Dorians, they dwelt then in the land now called Thessaliotes, and from the Pelasgians who settled Plassia and Sylace on the Hellespont, who became fellow inhabitants with the Athenians, and all the other Pelasgian towns that changed their name. If one must judge by these, the Pelasgians spoke a barbarian tongue. If then the whole Pelasgian people was of this kind, the Attic nation, being Pelasgian, must have changed its language too when it changed over to become Greek. For indeed the people of Crestona are not of the same speech as any of those now living around them, nor are the Plassians, but they are of the same speech as each other, which shows that they still preserve the form of language they brought with them when they resettled in those regions. As for the Hellenic people, it seems clear to me that it has always used the same language since it first came into being, but being weak when it split off from the Pelasgians, starting from small beginnings it grew into a multitude of nations, chiefly because many Pelasgians joined themselves to it, along with many other barbarian peoples besides. Before that, it seems to me, the Pelasgian nation, being a barbarian one, never grew to any great size. Of these nations, then, Croesus learned that the Attic one was held down and divided, at that time being under the tyranny of Pisistratus, son of Hippocrates, over the Athenians. For Hippocrates, while he was still a private citizen watching the Olympic Games, had a great portent occur to him. When he had performed the sacrifices, the cauldron standing there, full of meat and water, boiled and boiled over without any fire beneath them. Chilon the Lacedaemonian, who happened to be present and witnessed the portent, counseled Hippocrates that he should first refrain from bringing a child-bearing wife into his home, and if he already had one, to send her away, and if he happened to have a son, to disown him. Hippocrates, however, did not Hippocrates was willing to be persuaded by Chilon. From him afterward was born this Pisistratus, who, when the Athenians of the coast and the Athenians of the plain were in factional strife, the former led by Megacles, son of Alcmaeon, the latter by Lycurgus, son of Aristolades, conceived a contempt for tyranny and raised up a third faction. Gathering partisans and posing in speech as champion of the men beyond the hills, he contrived the following scheme. Having wounded himself and his mules, he drove his team into the marketplace, as though fleeing from enemies who, by his own account, had tried to murder him on his way out to his fields. And he asked the people to grant him some guard for his person, having earlier won good repute in his generalship against the Megareans, having taken Nicaea and performed other great deeds. The Athenian people, deceived, gave him men chosen from the citizens, who did not become spearmen for Peisistratus but club bearers, for they carried wooden clubs and followed behind him. These men rose up together with Peisistratus and seized the Acropolis. Their Peisistratus ruled the Athenians, disturbing neither the existing offices nor changing the laws, but administering the city on the basis of the established order, governing it well and fairly. But after not much time had passed, the partisans of Megacles and those of Lycurgus came to the same mind and drove him out. Thus Peisistratus held Athens the first time, and, his tyranny not yet firmly rooted, he lost it. Those who had driven out Peisistratus then fell again into strife with one another. Hard pressed by the factional struggle, Megacles sent word to Peisistratus asking whether he wished to have his daughter as wife on condition of the tyranny. Peisistratus accepted the proposal and agreed to these terms, and then they contrived, for his return, a scheme most simple-minded, as I find it, by far. Since the Greek people had long since been set apart from the barbarian race as being both cleverer and more free of foolish simplicity. If indeed these men, among the Athenians who were said to be foremost of the Greeks in wisdom, contrived a plot of this sort. In the deme of Paeania there was a woman named Phaia, lacking 3 fingers breadth of 4 cubits in height, and otherwise well-formed. This woman they equipped in full armor, mounted on a chariot, and having arranged for her a posture such as would appear most fitting, they drove her into the city, sending heralds ahead of them, who, on arriving in the city, proclaimed as they had been instructed, saying, "Athenians, receive Peisistratus with good will, him whom Athena herself, having honored above all men, is bringing back to her own Acropolis." So they went about saying this, and at once a report reached the deems that Athena was bringing Peisistratus back, and the people in the city, believing the woman to be the goddess herself, prayed to the human being and received Peisistratus. Having recovered the tyranny in the manner described, Peisistratus, in accordance with the agreement made with Megacles, married Megacles' daughter. But since he already had grown sons and the Alcmaeonidae were said to be under a curse, not wishing children to be born to him from his newly wed wife, he had intercourse with her not in the customary manner. At first the woman kept this hidden, but afterward, whether she was questioned or not, she told her own mother, and the mother told her husband. In his anger as it was, he reconciled his quarrel with his fellow partisans. When Peisistratus learned what was being done against him, he departed from the country altogether, and arriving at Eretria, he took counsel together with his sons. The opinion of Hippias prevailing that they should recover the tyranny back again, they then set about gathering gifts from the cities, whichever of them owed them some favor. Many gave large sums, but the Thebans surpassed all in the amount of money given. After that, not to speak at length, time passed and everything was prepared for their return, for Argive mercenaries came from the Peloponnese, and a Naxian man had arrived as a volunteer, whose name was Lygdamis, who showed the greatest zeal, bringing both money and men. Setting out from Eretria, they returned in the 11th year and first took Marathon in Attica. While they were encamped in that place, their partisans from the city arrived, and others streamed in from the demes, men for whom tyranny was more welcome than freedom. These then gathered together, but the Athenians from the city, so long as Peisistratus was collecting money, and afterward when he took Marathon, paid no attention. But when they learned that he was marching from Marathon against the city, then indeed they went out to help against him. Both this force marched out in full strength against the returning men and Peisistratus' party, once they had set out from Marathon and were marching toward the city, coming together to the same point, arrived at the shrine of Athena of Pallene, and set their arms opposite each other. There, by divine guidance, there came to Peisistratus a soothsayer named Amphiletus of Acarnania, who, approaching him, prophesied in hexameter verse, saying as follows. The cast is thrown, the net is spread wide, the tunnies will dart through the moonlit night. This he prophesied to him in a state of divine possession, and Peisistratus, grasping the oracle and declaring that he accepted what was prophesied, led on his army. The Athenians from the city had by that time turned to their midday meal, and after the meal some of them turned to dice, others to sleep. Peisistratus' men, falling upon the Athenians, routed them. As they fled, Peisistratus then devised a most clever plan, so that the Athenians might not gather together again, but remain scattered. He had his sons mount on horses and sent them ahead, and they, overtaking the fugitives, spoke the words Peisistratus had instructed them to say, telling them to take courage and to go each to his own home. The Athenians obeyed, and thus Peisistratus, holding Athens for the third time, rooted his tyranny firmly, with many mercenaries and with revenues of money, some gathered locally, others coming in from the river Strymon, and taking as hostages the sons of the Athenians who had remained and had not fled at once, he settled them in Naxos. For this island too Peisistratus had subdued by war and entrusted to Lygdamis. And in addition to these things, he purified the island of Delos according to the oracles, purifying it in this manner. As far as the view of the sanctuary extended, from that entire area he dug up the dead and carried them to another part of Delos. And so Peisistratus was tyrant of Athens, while of the Athenians, part had died in the fighting, and the rest, together with the Alcmaeonidae, went into exile from their own land. Such, then, was the condition in which Croesus learned that the Athenians were, at that time, being held. But the Lacedaemonians, having escaped great troubles and being now superior in war to the Tegeans, for under the kingship of Leon and Hegesicles in Sparta, while succeeding in their other wars, the Lacedaemonians met with failure only against the Tegeans. Still earlier than this, they had been about the worst governed of almost all the Greeks, both among themselves and in dealings with strangers, with whom they had no contact. But they changed to good order in this way. When Lycurgus, a man of repute among the Spartiates, went to Delphi to consult the oracle, as soon as he entered the temple, the Pythia at once said this: "You come, Lycurgus, to my rich temple, dear to Zeus and to all who hold Olympian homes. I am in doubt whether to declare you a god or a man in my prophecy, but I am inclined rather still to believe you a god, Lycurgus." Beyond this, certain accounts also hold that the Pythia went on to tell him the order of government now established for the Spartiates. But as the Lacedaemonians themselves say, Lycurgus, when he was guardian of Leobotes, his own nephew and king of the Spartiates, brought these things from Crete. His very first act as guardian was to overhaul all the established customs, and he made sure these were not transgressed. And afterward, he established the arrangements pertaining to war, the anomosiae, the triacads, and the common messes, and in addition to these, he set up the ephors and the elders, did Lycurgus. Thus, by this change, they attained good order, and when Lycurgus died, they built him a shrine and honor him greatly. And since they were in a good land and had no small number of men, they quickly flourished and prospered, and were no longer content to remain at peace, but holding the Arcadians in contempt as inferior to themselves, they consulted the oracle at Delphi concerning the whole land of the Arcadians. The Pythia gave them this response: "You ask me for Arcadia, you ask for much, I will not grant it. There are many acorn-eating men in Arcadia who will prevent you. Yet I do not begrudge you everything. Tegea I will grant you, a floor to beat with dancing feet, and her lovely plain to portion out by the measuring cord." When the Lacedaemonians heard this reported to them, they kept away from the rest of the Arcadians, but carrying fetters, they marched against the Tegeans, relying on the deceptive oracle, as expecting to enslave the Tegeans. But they were defeated in the encounter, and as many of them as were taken alive worked the plain of the Tegeans wearing the very fetters they had brought with them, and measured it out with a line. These fetters in which they had been bound were still, even to my own time, preserved safe at Tegea, hanging around the temple of Athena Aleia. In the earlier war, then, they had continually fared badly against the Tegeans. But by the time of Croesus and the reign of Anaxandrides and Ariston in Lacedaemon, the Spartiates had by then become superior in the war, having come to this by the following means. Since they were continually being defeated in the war by the Tegians, they sent sacred envoys to Delphi to ask which god they should propitiate to become superior to the Tegians in the war. The Pythia told them to bring back the bones of Orestes, son of Agamemnon. But since Orestes' resting place proved impossible for them to find, they sent to the god a second time to inquire where Orestes lay buried. When the sacred envoys asked this, the Pythia said the following: "There is a Tegea in a level place of Arcadia, where two winds blow under strong compulsion, and blow answers blow, and there is a form, counterblow, and woe is laid upon woe. There the earth that gives life holds the son of Agamemnon. Bring him home, and you will be Tegea's master." When the Lacedaemonians heard this too, they were no closer to the discovery, search as they might, until at last Lyches, one of the so-called benefactors among the Spartiates, found it out. The benefactors are citizens who, being the eldest to retire each year from the cavalry, are dispatched by the Spartan state, 5 each year. For that year, when they retire from the cavalry, they are sent about on public business and must not sit idle in one place. It was one of these men, Lyches, who made the discovery in Tegea, by a stroke of luck and cleverness together. At that time, there was free intercourse between Sparta and Tegea, and he went into a smithy and watched iron being forged, marveling at what he saw being done. The smith noticed him marveling and said, stopping his work, "Well, Spartan stranger, if you had seen what I have seen, you would be marveling in earnest, since you make such a wonder now of the working of iron. I wanted to dig a well in this courtyard here, and digging I came upon a coffin 7 cubits long. Since I could not believe that men were ever bigger than they are now, I opened it and saw the corpse lying there, equal in length to the coffin. I measured it and then covered it over again." So the smith told him what he had seen, and Lyches, turning the words over, reckoned that this must be Orestes, in keeping with the oracle, reasoning it out thus. Seeing the smith's two bellows, he took them for the winds, and the anvil and the hammer for the blow and the counterblow, and the iron being forged for the woe laid upon woe, guessing at it this way, that iron had been discovered to men's harm. Having worked this out, he went back to Sparta and told the Lacedaemonians the whole matter. They, framing a false charge against him, drove him out. He, arriving in Tegea and telling his misfortune to the smith, tried to rent the courtyard from him, but the man would not give it up. In time he persuaded him, and moved in, he dug up the grave, gathered the bones, and went off carrying them to Sparta. And from that time on, whenever the two sides put each other to the test, the Lacedaemonians got much the better of it in war. And by then, most of the Peloponnese had already been subdued by them. All this Croesus learned, and he sent messengers to Sparta bearing gifts and asking for an alliance, having instructed them what they must say. On arriving, they declared, "We come sent by Croesus, who rules as king over the Lydians and other peoples, with this message. Lacedaemonians, since the god has decreed that I make the Greek my friend, for I learn that you stand at the head of Greece, I now call upon you, in accordance with the oracle, wishing to become your friend and ally, without deceit or trickery." Thus Croesus made his overture through messengers, and the Lacedaemonians, who had themselves already heard of the oracle given to Croesus, welcomed the arrival of the Lydians and swore oaths of friendship and alliance. For indeed they were bound to Croesus by certain kindnesses done to them earlier. For the Lacedaemonians had sent to Sardis to buy gold, wishing to use it for a statue, the one of Apollo that now stands at Thornax in Laconia, and Croesus, when they came to buy it, gave it to them as a gift. For these reasons, then, the Lacedaemonians accepted the alliance, and also because, judging them above every other Greek people, he had singled them out to be his friends. And they were ready, for their part, to answer his call. And further, they made a bronze mixing bowl, covered on the outside around the rim with figures, and holding, in size, 300 amphorae, and they brought it, wishing to give it to Croesus in return. This bowl never reached Sardis, for two reasons that are given. The Lacedaemonians say that when the bowl, being carried to Sardis, came near Samos, the Samians, learning of it, sailed out with warships and seized it. But the Samians themselves say that when the Lacedaemonians carrying the bowl were delayed, and learned that Sardis and Croesus had been taken, they sold the bowl in Samos, and private men bought it and dedicated it in the Herion. It may be that the sellers, on returning to Sparta, would say that they had been robbed of it by the Samians. So much, then, for the bowl. Croesus, For his part, having misread the oracle, made an expedition against Cappadocia, hoping to bring down Cyrus and the power of the Persians. As Croesus made ready to take the field against the Persians, a certain Lydian already reputed wise, whose opinion had earned him no small renown among the Lydians, offered Croesus this counsel. His name was Sandanes. "O king, you are preparing to march against men of such a kind, who wear leather trousers and all their other clothing of leather, and who eat not what they wish but what they have, since they hold a rugged country. Moreover, they do not indulge in wine but drink water, and have no figs to eat, nor any other good thing.